what I call the thought cycle, and it's that your thoughts will lead to an emotion or a feeling, which will ultimately lead to some kind of action that you take, will then lead to a result.
That was Harry Kalymnios, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back, everyone, to the All Things Risk Podcast. This is episode 19, and my name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is a show where I explore the themes of risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness through various long-form conversations with interesting people, and today is no exception. It's summer, and it's the Olympics time, which is great. I'm enjoying watching the Olympics. I hope you're enjoying the summer wherever you are, or the winter, as it were, if you're in the southern hemisphere. I do have some listeners down under and in the southern hemisphere. Hope you are enjoying the winter, and rest assured that summer is just around the corner for you guys. Before I get into the guest, I just wanted to outline a little bit what it takes to produce a single podcast episode for me, and just emphasize I do this as a labor of love. I do it in my spare time. I have a full-time job that in itself can be very demanding, and in each episode I need to invite the guests, make scheduling work. I need to do some preparation before I have the conversation. And then I get to do the fun part, which is the actual conversation, the part that you get to listen to. Then it's all about editing and promoting. And it can be a fair bit of work. It certainly is a pleasure, and the show will always be free. But I do want the show to reach as many people as it possibly can, and I would love if you could help me out in that regard. If you enjoy the show, please share it with others, either on social media through your networks or just simply via word of mouth. That would be great. Provide a review or a rating on iTunes. That would help a lot. That bumps up the show in terms of its visibility, and that really helps. The show will, as I mentioned, will always be free, but it isn't free in terms of my time, and I want to make sure that it reaches the most people that it possibly can. Thank you to those who've done that already, and if you haven't, please consider doing so. That would help a lot. So today, it's August, and I wanted to, first of all, start the introduction to my guest by saying that I absolutely hate New Year's resolutions because they always fail. So I think it's appropriate that we talk about things like improving resilience, improving your strength, improving the way in which you go about performing, doing all kinds of things in August rather than in January, because the conversation today, I think, is going to be a lot more helpful to many of us in terms of making some positive changes than what we might consider doing around January 1st. And I have on the show Harry Kalymnios, who is a keynote speaker. He's a trainer. He is an executive coach, an author, a TEDx speaker, and many other things. And we talk about making positive changes in our lives, talk about many things, but one of the themes is making positive changes in our lives, becoming more resilient in a way that does not rely on those popular but cliched methods that ultimately fail. And Harry is all about helping people become what he likes to call super leaders. He owns a leadership training company called The Thought Gym here in London. And that's all about helping people and organizations achieve self-leadership mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. He has an interesting background, and we have a wonderful conversation in which Harry offers some great tools and insights that I think can help us all dial up our energy, our performance, and meet and overcome challenges that we might be facing. The conversation was loads of fun. We really got lost in it. We explore Harry's background. He spent some time in some interesting places, and he's done some interesting things. But ultimately, what or how all of that led him into getting into training and coaching, what he's learned from studying high performers. So he looked at a whole range of people that you might want to call high performers and try to pull out some of the things that they had in common. We talk about mental strength. We talk about building energy. We talk about food and nutrition, which is very important, daily rituals, and adopting new and positive habits in a way that will stick. And that really gets into things like the limits of willpower and things that we often rely upon. We talk about fixed versus growth mindsets. And of course, this being the All Things Risk podcast, we talk about risk. And we have a great conversation about risk. In fact, intelligent risk taking and resilience. We talk about the power of consistency and a whole lot more. It's a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. One word of warning, we got interrupted twice, so I had to edit out the bits where we got interrupted, and I think I did a decent job of doing that, but if it jumps a couple of times, and we do pick up the conversation, I think, quite well where we left off, but if it does seem to jump a couple of times, that's why, but I don't think it detracts at all from the quality of the conversation. I think we managed that well, but that does represent some of the risks of having what I like to call the All Things Risks mobile studios, which I carry around to do some of my conversations. At any rate, it's a great conversation, as I said. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Harry Kalymnios. Harry, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast.
My pleasure to be here.
So, first question, it's a question that I ask a lot of my guests, which is, what do you do? And I'm always after the answer that's not straightforward, because the people that say I'm a this or I'm a that, it's more interesting the people that really struggle to answer that question. Okay. And you strike me as somebody who probably does a little bit, so that'd be great if we just start with that.
What I say is I help people become superhuman. That's my intro, and we can go into more about what mm-hmm. that means exactly, but it's helping people to think, feel, and be the best that they can possibly be, so that they can be ultimately the best self-leaders and therefore leaders of others mm-hmm. that they can be. Because mm-hmm. my philosophy around leadership is that if you want to lead other people, the first person you need to be able to lead is yourself, and that you can only really lead yourself optimally if you're on point mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I've kind of dedicated the last decade, or the best part of the last decade, to understanding what it does take to optimize yourself in those areas. And you know, if you imagine where you are on your best ever day, just kind of 10x-ing that and thinking, well, that's me feeling superhuman. So it's not necessarily about, you know, doing cartwheels down the street or jumping across buildings, but it's like when everything's on point for you, you know, when you're focused, when you've got the best health, vitality, working relationships, a level of resilience, calm, balance, that to me is superhuman, and also operating at a superior level to the average person in the street. So yeah, that's what I help people.
That's very cool. I want to get into all of that, and we will get into all that. One of the things about just having that feeling of, you call it superhuman, or even just that feeling of, I actually feel good or really good. I think a lot of people they kind of sleepwalk through their days. They're sort of very zombie-like. Mm-hmm. I see it at work. I see it with the people around me. Lots of cups of coffee to get yourself going and just kind of making it through the day and, you know, getting to the weekend and trying to, you know, just trying to make it through the week. And it's an existence that is, it's mundane, but until I've noticed, until you start to do something about that, you don't really notice what it feels like to feel actually great, was actually should just be normal.
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know. And, you know, there are many things that I still have yet to experience and that I'm completely unconscious of right now. And it's just a level of consciousness, I guess, that, you know, I've now gone from one place to another. And like you mentioned, you see lots of people, especially in the city of London, walking around in an autopilot zombie state. Yeah. And, you know, maybe I was like that. Maybe I wasn't quite as bad. I don't know. But certainly my level of awareness and my level of consciousness has definitely somewhat changed since then, and I'm a lot more aware of my behaviours and where I, how I feel and what I'm doing and the world around me than I once was.
That, very cool. I mean, the city of London, it feels like the Matrix at times, just walking through there. But I guess to start off with, how did you come to do what you do?
It was funny enough, I used to work, one of the buildings was literally over the road from me. So I used to work at the London Stock Exchange. I joined them via Accenture, so the big kind of management consultancy.
I'm a former Accenturite as well.
I joined Accenture like through the back door, so I wasn't through management consulting. Mm-hmm. And so I was within services, so they were dedicated to one client generally. So I worked for Accenture for 3 years at the London Stock Exchange, then directly for the London Stock Exchange for 3 years, doing a variety of roles from IT operations overnight to then I got into service management, which is that kind of go-between between the IT and the business, and then project management and service introduction work. And I had been there for about 6 years, and I never really like hated my job. I've always been like, it's been okay. It wasn't like that I aspired to do that. I went to university, then I went traveling for a few years, and I didn't have any idea when I came back what I wanted to do, and fell into a few jobs, from working in my local pub to working at my sister's law firm to eventually at Accenture. And it's like, I've got a first class physics degree, what am I doing? Is this what I should be doing? I was just sitting doing my day job and had been wanting to leave for probably 2 years, three years, as long as I could remember, and not knowing to leave to what. It's like, you know, and all I'd really known career wise was that for like a good portion. And around 2010, there were lots of changes going on at Stock Exchange. We had a new head CIO kind of person came in, there were some changes, some people making redundancies. My entire team got made redundant except for myself, for various reasons. And then, but I wanted the redundancy, and I thought, you know, maybe this is an opportunity. And I eventually managed to get redundancy and decided to go on an NLP course. So NLP is
neuro-linguistic programming.
And I'd been interested in NLP since 2006 when I came across it in a book and had done some.
What is it for my listeners that don't know anything about it?
The simple way
I
like to describe neuro-linguistic programming, because it's like the worst named subject in the world, is really a collection of tools which helps you understand not why you think the way you do, but how you think the way you do, how you communicate. And really it's dissecting and labeling, for the most part, things that we already do but are not maybe conscious of them. So for example, when you're really in rapport with a person, like a friend, what is it specifically that's happening there that then can be maybe replicated elsewhere so that you can build rapport with other people as well? And there are a lot of other tools, such as understanding how we think in terms of pictures and sounds in our head, and how we can maybe adjust those qualities to make us either like or dislike certain things or certain habits or behaviours. And it's a shortcut way of getting good results. It's not a magic wand or anything.
It has a sort of a Jedi mind trick reputation about it.
But I think that for sometimes people think, well, it's all a bit mind tricky, but actually it's not really. It's like having a knife and saying a knife is dangerous, or a knife, it can create amazing kind of dinners and chop up vegetables and everything. It depends how you use it.
Right.
And generally speaking, you know, a bit like hypnosis or anything else, you can't be made to do things a lot of
sure
time.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just an opening, and so I went on an NLP course, and then that led me to meet some interesting people, one of which told me about a personal development group in London, which ironically now I'm the leader of, 5.5 years later. And I went along to that group, and through that group I found out about other events. I found out about this world of personal development, really, although I'd kind of skirted in and out a few years earlier, but I found the real stuff really. And I went to some events, and I went to one event in beginning of January 2011.
Welcome to Unified Conferencing.
Sorry.
I went to one event at the beginning of January 2011, and the guy on stage was like, he looked about 35, but he was like in his late 50s. He was rocking the stage for like 14 hours a day, you know, 2 days straight, unbelievable energy.
Like and a Tony Robbins type
it
guy.
It was, in fact, his head trainer.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a guy called Joseph McLennan the third. And so super energetic guy, if anyone's familiar with him. And I was like...
Keep going.
Yeah, so at the end of the two-day event, he was advertising a health retreat called the Z Factor, I think it was called. And he brought on all these people who had testimonials, had been there before. And, you know, there was a lawyer who shed loads of weight and went through the whole of London winter with no cold or anything like that. And it was like a £3,000 event for like 3 days. And so I spoke to a few of the people at the end because I was like, do I really want to invest £3,000? 3 days, and one of the guys was saying, well, he just brings on this guy who wrote this book and told me the book, and I was like, well, £5 here on Amazon, £3,000 here. I was like, I'll just buy the book.
Yeah.
And so I bought the book and read it, and I think something sunk in to the subconscious there. I didn't really actively do anything much with it, and then over Lent, most years I decide to give up something or start something new as a period, and I decided to give up meat as an experiment. And I'd done that before 10 years previously, and I just noticed when I went back to eating meat on Easter Sunday that I suddenly was really tired and needed to sleep for about 2 hours straight after the food. And then it kind of, for some reason, a penny dropped, and I was like, you know, the previous 7 weeks I had had more energy, I needed less sleep, I liked my food, so I could eat more and not feel as bloated, and just felt generally better. So I thought, well, let me experiment with that, with maybe not buying meat and just having it when I'm out at a nice place. And then that kind of just snowballed, and I didn't have it, and it kind of just led me down this rabbit hole of health and vitality and understanding and just exploring other high performers. And so I started going to lots of seminars, I started reading lots of books and audio programs, and started to notice various patterns in the behavior of these people, whether it was what they were eating or whether what they were drinking or what they were doing in their day-to-day. And I started adopting those habits and behaviors for my own purposes to see what it'd be like. So whether that was, you know, starting to take up meditation or to green juice or to journal or to have a gratitude list or whatever it might be. And I made tons of changes, like 50, 100 changes.
And then over the course of how long?
I guess, well, I remember making around 30 changes in about a month, which is a huge amount.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to people. But that was like from, you know, stopping drinking tea and coffee to starting to rebound in the morning, which is like bouncing up and down on mini trampoline to visualization. And because I remember I'm a bit kind of, what they call it in NLP, AD, analog digital. I'm kind of like, I like to kind of have things on paper and stuff and quite analytical. And so I remember listing those things. So I remember there's a list somewhere of those 30 things, but it was probably about 50, 100 over the time. And then a few years ago, I thought, right, I'm just going to put all this together and see what I've been doing. And then from there, I formulated a teachable process to other people.
Right.
But for me, I guess the reason why I was so into it in the first place was because I left the stock exchange and I had gone on this NLP course, and somewhere along the line, I got it into my head that, okay, it would be nice to kind of coach people and teach people something around either the NLP or some other tools that could be useful for them. And it never crossed my mind beforehand. And when I started learning NLP and other such modalities, I realized that there's so much out there that people aren't aware of. And they kept talking about coaching and when you coach your clients. And I was thinking to myself, and I've just come to my own benefit. What do you mean when I coach my clients? And I thought, oh, maybe I should be a coach, maybe. And as I started just going down that rabbit hole, and I started coaching people, and you know, deciding to write a book, and started to, like I say, study lots of high performers, and that really is kind of it. And now it's a case of wanting to teach more people. So that, whether that's via the YouTube videos, whether that's corporate training, which is another big passion of mine, helping those corporates out there. with their young leaders to help train and retain leaders by increasing their resilience.
Harry, I was just, you're talking about getting into coaching, and I was actually going to ask you whether or not you always thought you would do that kind of a thing, or if you got into it, because there are a lot of coaches out there, and there are some that seem pretty good, and then there's some that you just wonder, you know, it almost feels inauthentic. Mm. There's a lot of stuff that feels like it's just, you know, people out there who kind of repackage stuff, and then they kind of en masse they produce it. And so I was just wondering if it's something that you always thought you would do, or something that you kind of fell into and started to really enjoy.
Yeah, it's not something I necessarily even contemplated that this was a career. I think I vaguely had heard of this idea of life coaching about a decade ago, and people were saying this will be a big thing coming up.
Yeah.
I've always been drawn to, I guess, helping people and teaching people. And I had thought many moons ago I'd be a teacher, but I was like, no, I wouldn't be a teacher. Both my parents are teachers, and I thought, I can't be a teacher. There's no money in teaching, and it's challenging. People don't really want to learn sometimes. Yeah. And because I remember even, like, you know, teaching one of my schoolmates, like, A-level maths to help him get an A and everything. And so I've always been drawn to that, and then I discovered, actually, you know what, there's this idea of training and coaching, and, you know, and people want to learn from you, and people value your experience and your opinion, and, you know, and there's a different way of coaching as well, because there are, you know, the pure coaching model where you are, like, not really offering anything except questions and asking the person to really come up with the results, which is a large part. I guess I do a split between coaching and / mentoring. I'm the person that's been there before and can help explain, rather than pure asking the questions, because they're not really coming to me for that necessarily. Sometimes they're coming to me because I can save them months or years of research into understanding what it takes to live with health, vitality, energy. But yeah, in short, you know, I didn't think about this when I was doing my degree or anything like
that. Yeah, which is some of the best choices turn out to be like that, right? The non-linear paths and choices are often the most interesting and the most satisfying. I did want to talk a little bit about, so I want to go back to this concept of being superhuman, and I wanted to talk, I want to get your views on what that means. I listened to your TEDx talk, which was great, but I wanted to maybe delve into some of this stuff in some detail, maybe particularly the physical side, the kind of emotional side. But what does that mean, being superhuman?
On a broad level, it means operating at a level better than those around me that I see. It means being able to get up with energy. It means not, like I used to suffer from, like, 4, 5, 6 colds a year to now I think I've maybe had one in the last 5 years, from just everything feeling and working better, whether that's your eyes being brighter, your skin being better, your focus being sharper, your relationships with other people being more improved. So wherever you were before, but just amplifying that. That's what being superhuman to me means. It's living at close to, if not your potential as a human being. And there's many aspects to that. So whether that's improving your reading speed and memory, which I've done courses to do, or whether that's to improve your ability to bounce back from maybe an illness that you might get, or whether that's just having that zing in your step, that to me is about being superhuman.
Right.
Because then you, at least I found anyway, when I was doing this, so after I left the stock exchange, I actually went and worked in as a contractor for Sainsbury's. And what I found, because I was starting this journey, that I could do basically more work in less time than my colleagues, and do the kind of bonus work as well. So outside of my remit, that I would, you know, my manager would kind of call on me to, you know, if we're creating new templates or new whatever it might be to help assist the team. And, you know, I wasn't drawn into the office politics. I wasn't drawn into the stresses of it all. I was just able to work really a lot more effectively, a lot more productively, which also allowed me then time to spend the energy on my other projects. And mm-hmm. when I was at Sainsbury's, I was like, I want to do my own stuff, but I know that I need to be able to do stuff before work and after work. And so, you know, whether that was getting up early, like at 6, and getting to the mm-hmm. leaving the house at 7, getting to the gym for 7:30, doing an hour in the gym, working my 9 to sort of, I guess it was about 5:30, 6 o'clock, because mm-hmm. that place, a lot of people left by about 10 past 5. And then I would go and join, like say, a Toastmasters, which is a public speaking training, because mm-hmm. I wanted to improve my public speaking skills, and then come back at like 10, 11 from that, and then sleep the 6 hours, which isn't something I'd necessarily advocate now. But I was able to do it with no problems whatsoever.
So where did that journey start for you? Was it in you talk a lot about energy just now. So did it start with just dialing up your energy and your health first?
Really, I guess I've always been into fitness, mm-hmm. But I never really. I always thought fitness and health were the same thing, right? And
they're
definitely not. And it was really only about 5 years ago that I kind of made that demarcation in the sand, if you like, because I was the kind of person that was kind of blessed that I always had an athletic body, and I was always into like basketball, running, athletics, cycling, everything. But I would still eat the Big Mac. I would still
eat
up to 4 kebabs a week when I was at university, despite the fact I had a catered halls. And this is, you know, no word of lie, I was the kind of person that didn't even eat vegetables till I was 19 mm-hmm. years old, and salad around 16 years old. And the reason I ate vegetables was because at uni they only gave me like 3 potatoes with food instead of my usual 18. So I was kind of into fitness, but not so much the health aspect. But when I started contracting, I guess, I realised that I was on a day rate, okay, which meant, you know, you don't get the sick leave, you don't get any of this. Mm. And I guess the penny dropped is like, you know, if I'm ill, you know, I don't work,
yes.
I get paid.
Yes.
You know, if I can't turn up for whatever reason, I'm going to be struggling.
Yes.
And so I was like, it was really important for me to do that. And I guess the other thing was that I realized that everything, I mean, I guess I've got a physics background, but everything is energy. Everything fundamentally uh-huh. starts with energy. It's the E equals MC squared, mm-hmm. if you like, to mm-hmm. quote Einstein. Mm-hmm. And that it doesn't matter if, in my opinion, if you go to a course and you know all about goal setting, or you know all about the strategy for this, that and the other, but if you don't have the energy to work a 9-hour day, come home and write 2 chapters mm-hmm. of your book or a chapter of your book, you're not going to get out of that place where you want to be. If you don't have the energy to play with your niece or nephew or kids after you've had a long day or a long week, you know, you're going to miss out somewhere yes. there. If you don't have the energy to spend 12 hours shopping with your significant other, you know, you'll probably end up in an argument. So for me, it was like all about energy.
Yeah.
More so than it was health. Like some people get into the health world because mm-hmm. they have a health issue. I never really had a health, mm-hmm. health issue. Although I guess there's been a history of stuff in the family, but you know, I think I've got quite a strong constitution generally, and so I never had a health issue. But you know, I didn't even feel like I had an energy issue. I mean, compared to my friends, I was always more energized than them anyway. But just I realized that there was more to go, and seeing people like Joseph McClendon at, you know, 57, 58, whatever he was then, I think he's 60 something now, I was like, you know, it just challenged my beliefs, my paradigm, what it meant to age and what it meant to have illness. I mean, he said he hadn't had a cold in 27 years.
Wow.
And I was like, that's pretty good
credentials. What was his book, by the way, that you mentioned you purchased?
The book that it wasn't obviously Joseph's book, but it was the book was called The PH Miracle.
Okay.
Robert Young.
Okay.
And it's about
this alkalinity and stuff like that. Okay.
Which was a new concept to me at the time, but it, just the different alkaline and acid natures of food. And whilst, you know, he follows a different thing, I don't follow anyone to the letter. This is the thing, is you take all these resources, for myself included, and you pick and choose the things that make sense. You know, you try them on. Did it work? Keep it. Did it not work? Mm-hmm. Bin it, sort of thing. But I read that book, and a lot of the things I was either doing or planning to do, you know, and I remember even reading something in there where he was talking about fruit, mm-hmm. and because generally most fruit has an acidic effect on the body. And I was thinking, there's no way I would give up fruit or anything. And then I guess quite unconsciously now, I do have a bit of fruit, like as a treat. I don't tend to buy fruit unless it's frozen berries, which I put in a smoothie. But there is no fruit bowl in my house. Now, if my parents come round with a watermelon or something and they go on holiday, I will still have it, of course. And if I'm out and about and I had a piece of fruit the other day, but I don't buy it as part of my weekly shop, which is quite interesting. And I'm not sure if it was necessarily a conscious decision. It probably is now, but initially it wasn't. And I was like, all right, so I am doing that now. It's really weird, but yeah, it made a lot of sense, the book, and then it just kind of led me to read more other books. And you know, I happened to meet someone at the time that was of my similar thinking, and that kind of helped cement things. And
and then you got into doing this coaching stuff full time.
So I took the plunge about 3 years ago almost now to do it's a variety of coaching, training and public speaking.
Okay Very cool. Well, that's, you know, that's definitely an interesting journey. I was wondering if you could dive into this concept of energy a little bit more. So how do you dial up your energy? What are some of the things that people maybe don't realize that's maybe sapping their energy? Or
The main thing, I mean, there's a few things, but the main thing is that if you don't have energy, it's generally not because you have a deficiency of Red Bull in your system, or coffee. That's usually the wrong place to look. I would say how you move your body. We're very stationary a lot of the time. Sitting or standing or whatever it might be. Moving, you know, the universe, I mean, I say that you can find the answers to everything by looking at nature, right? And the universe is not static. We're not meant to be static. We need to move. So moving a lot, breathing, which kind of is restricted by how we sit a lot of the time anyway, but most people are not breathing correctly. So, you know, you want, generally, depending on what you're doing, but deep breaths into the belly, into the diaphragm, not into the chest. A lot of people do a lot of shallow chest breathing, which creates a lot more stress in the system, a lot more imbalances. And so breathing is the fundamental thing for energy. I would say if you're not feeling energized, think about taking some proper deep breaths, like 10, 20 deep breaths, ideally somewhere with cleanish air. Then look at your water consumption. So really look at how much water you've got. Most people, in my experience, are chronically dehydrated. Water and breathing should be the first two things that you think about when you're thinking that you're tired. But then food, super, super important. What kind of food are you having? Most people are having eternal spikes, sugar spikes. Processed food.
Anything that's processed is awful, isn't it?
Generally. I mean, I follow a bit of an 80-20 on that. 80-20 rule on that. But the closer you can get to kind of real food as possible, which basically means nothing with a packet generally, or nothing with a celebrity endorsement, nothing with an advert, or you know, nothing built for shelf life instead of self life. You know, you can effectively, in the supermarket, I don't go to the supermarket much, but you want to just stick to the first couple of aisles, the produce stuff, and then ignore the rest.
As close to as nature intended as possible.
And that's, you know, if we come onto the food philosophy, I'll explain it in my simple terms as well. So what you put into your food, into your mouth, basically, your breathing, your water. And the other thing, I guess, is... it's really about how you ritualize your day, because you are like one, or I am in control of how I feel, really. No one else is. Yeah. That was kind of a big revelation. And there are three things I say that determine how you feel in any given moment in time. One of which is attention. So what you decide to pay attention to, you know, are you paying attention to the fact that, you know, it's really sunny outside and you're stuck in an office, that's going to make you feel in a certain way, or are you paying attention to the fact that isn't it great you have a job and lots of people have lost their job, whatever it might be. The second one is what you assign to the meaning or language you assign to what you're paying attention to. So you might say, you know, God, it's such a hot, sweaty day. because you're paying attention to the fact it's sunny, or you could say, what a gorgeous sunny day. Mm-hmm. You're paying attention to the same thing, but the language you're using to describe it is very different. It's going to create mm-hmm. a different feeling in your body. And the third thing is A for action. So it's all three A's: attention, assign, and action. So the physical actions of your body will help create a certain mood. Mm-hmm. So whether that be, you know, very famous, I'm sure many people have come across the Amy Cuddy TED talk about power posing.
Yes.
And yes. The difference in cortisol levels and testosterone levels, and this is through your physical actions of your body. Mm. But it's just like, you know, smiling will ultimately eventually induce a happiness feeling.
Yes.
So the point being, when it comes to rituals, is that because I'm in control and I know that these three things control how I feel, I can, and if I want to feel energized, for example, I know that I can, for example, pay attention to something else. Okay, if I've had 1 hour sleep, it's going to be challenging, but how many times have we had 1 or 2 hours sleep and we're, I don't know, going on holiday, or if you're a kid, you're going to like Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
you know,
and
or,
it doesn't matter,
yeah,
that,
or you
for that
go
day,
meet the Queen,
yeah,
or
yeah.
Richard Branson,
yeah,
and you've only had 1 hour sleep. I'll bet you're gonna have energy then,
yeah.
Now you can't do this day in, day out, but you've got the energy because you're paying attention to something else, you're excited,
yeah.
Or for me, something I do, I mentioned it earlier, is this thing called rebounding, like mm-hmm. bouncing up mm-hmm. and down on a mini trampoline for about 10-15 mm-hmm. minutes every morning, because I know that energizes me. It moves the lymph fluid, which is the kind of sewage system in your body,
mm-hmm.
if you like, and the lymph fluid doesn't have a pump, like the heart pumps the blood around the body.
Okay.
The lymph fluid can only move really through deep diaphragmatic breathing, mm-hmm. or diaphragmatic breathing, and movement. So mm-hmm. exercise. So if you do that first thing in the morning, you're effectively
cleaning out
your system, getting rid of all the crap. And so for me, that wakes me up. So I know if I just roll out of bed like I used to,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not going to feel the energy. If mm-hmm. But now I know I have a routine, which if I do everything takes a long time, but about mm-hmm. 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But that includes a number of things, including like maybe an hour's worth of proper exercise. Because the rebounding is
okay.
Like I say, just to wake me up.
Just to wake you up. That's really interesting. A number of fascinating stuff there. One of the things that I've taken away, and I'm a very analytical person. I've always been like that. Always been sort of very, I guess, book smart in many ways. Mm-hmm. And my philosophy on life for, you know, a good chunk of my years until the last maybe decade or just over a decade is that I can think my way through anything. That being smart is the way, you know, that to get through life, and that ignores the whole mind body connection, which you know, when you talk about things like, you know, going for walks, changing your outlook, breathing, all that stuff really reconnects you know mind and body. And we've really, as a Western culture, don't have that tradition, that sort of that history of paying attention to all that. And that's where I think people are starting to make, you know, the stuff that you do, I mean, it's revelatory for a lot of people, because, you know, these two things are seen as polar opposites.
Yeah, I mean, the body and the mind, there is no real separation.
Yeah.
And you can even extend that further if you want to other bodies and minds, if you want to go a bit more woo-woo and esoteric.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true. And, you know, it's something I'm deeply involved in and passionate about, which started before really all the NLP stuff, was, you know, yoga. And I started mm-hmm. yoga back in 2006, but a consistent practice from 2008, so around 7-8 years now. So big focus on the breath, and obviously the Western yoga is not yoga of days of mm-hmm. old. The yoga that we practice in the West is what they call asana yoga. Asana meaning seat, and these were different poses to mm-hmm. help prepare the body for meditation. But even those poses have only come around in the last few hundred years. But yoga has been a science, if you like, from the east, for about 3,000 years. But anyway, for the most people, yoga is this: go to the gym and do things. And a lot of people find benefits, whether that's stress reduction, mm-hmm. and obviously you get increased strength, balance, flexibility, and everything else. So yoga has been a big part, and everything just lines up. And like I said, when I start looking at these high performers, you know, how many of them happen to do some sort of yoga or qigong or tai chi
yes.
practice? How many are meditating?
What did you find? I'm curious. What, in terms of, do they all or the majority have a practice like like meditation or yoga?
Yeah.
I mean, interesting.
Yeah, I'd say 8 out of 10.
Right.
So you would have some sort of meditative practice or some kind of personal being and space practice. So a lot of time I used to, for example, first thing in the morning, the alarm goes off and it went to like a radio alarm. And suddenly you've got either the news or adverts or, or even if you've not got that, you've got like music. And a lot of people can't be with themselves. Very challenging. Now I wake up and there's, you know, there's silence and I'm happy enough with that. It's fine. I do then put on a podcast later when I'm doing stuff, but not until I've gone through a little part of my routine. But it was very challenging when I was living alone before to be in silence. And then I was in a relationship for a long time, and she, I guess, kind of helped get me away from that in a way. Not to say any of this is that's necessarily good or bad, but it's just recognizing, because I say nothing is good or bad in this life, but one thing will give you one outcome and another thing will give you another outcome, and you have to be, I guess, cognizant of the fact of what outcome is given you and whether that's one that you want. So eating Big Macs is not bad, but it's not good either. It just means that if you eat Big Macs every day, like the guy in Supersize Me, this will be your outcome. Now, if that's what you're after, then that's a good outcome. But if it's not what you're after, it's probably not a good outcome. But the point is, yes, a lot of these people, whether it's someone like Oprah Winfrey, I like doing some of her meditations with Deepak Chopra sometimes, which are guided meditations. So whether it's her or whether Tim Ferriss, you know, meditative practice of some sort. So, or a yogic practice of some sort. There are patterns. You follow the clues, really. But like I said, I came into yoga before I came into this personal development world as such, but it works so well.
I guess as we start to, because I originally asked you about this question of energy, and we started to go into lots of stuff, because I guess, you know, all of this stuff, you know, dials up your energy. One of the things that, you know, I was reading a post, and I can't remember where I came across this, but it was just shortly after New Year. So it was a New Year's, you know, you get the same sorts of things, you know, diet, exercise, all that stuff. And I think you have an interesting take on willpower, because for a lot of people, the way that you do that, so diet, for example, I'm just going to eat, you know, fresh vegetables 80% of the time or whatever, they'll use willpower to try to get through that, and inevitably that, you know, you run out of that. And if you want to make a change, I mean, for me, I found you just go small, you know, change small habits, you know, one at a time. Don't try and do the whole lot, and that starts to make a shift. But if it's just all about willpower, you know, I think even the strongest person will run out. So so how do you make a change that's sustainable in your experience?
Like I say, willpower comes and wanes and comes in peaks and troughs throughout the day, depending on the time of day, what you've been doing, how much you've eaten as well. So for me, it's around changing the mindset, which is why my whole brand was called The Thought Gym.
Okay.
So for me, I recognize early on that until you make changes to your mind and what's going on between your ears, everything else is likely to kind of falter or fail. Because many people have, like I say, been on a diet, then they come off a diet, they join a gym, then they give up by February. And, you know, for me to, it doesn't take willpower now for me not to eat meat. I was a big carnivore. I don't eat meat now. I haven't eaten it for 5.5 years, but there's no desire to, because there's been a fundamental shift in both values and beliefs. So there's different levels that you can make changes, but the highest level that you can make really is either to a change in your values or beliefs or your identity. So if you see yourself as someone that is, I'm always on a diet, and that's your identity, it means you're always going to be on a diet. So it's the hardest thing in a way to change a person's identity or purpose or mission. But if you were able to change that, it'd be very, very easy to change everything else. So that's what, you know, my first book was about. It's about changing that mindset.
Okay.
But, you know, like you already alluded to, having tiny habits, having small things that you can maybe put into place. Because sometimes you forget, like for example, just a small thing, like I soak the fresh nuts and seeds overnight before I use them the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wasn't a case of, because for sometimes I say to people, if you've got a big enough why, you'll make that habit a reality. Now, this wasn't a case of needing a big why. It was just like sometimes I would forget, you know.
Mm.
So anything you repeatedly do, though, becomes a habit. So I would forget one night, I'd do it the next night, whatever. Now, as soon as I've, you know, taken my glass of water for the evening, because it's anchored in, that at that time I'm doing it, it's automated and it's a small habit. So if you can include small habits, if you can anchor them to existing habits, it's a really mm-hmm. powerful way of doing it. So if you know that every time you step out the shower, you're going to do 3 press-ups, for example, pretty soon you might have to have a conscious awareness of it for a while, but then that habit will be linked into coming out the shower, and it'll probably mm-hmm. be linked to coming out of any shower, not just that particular shower. Mm-hmm. So linking habits is a great way of doing things. But yeah, ultimately willpower doesn't last. Discipline, determination, all of this is great stuff to get you going, and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I say to people, you need to look at how you can shift your beliefs and your values, because ultimately your decisions are driven by those, and it becomes very easy to change behaviors if you can shift your values and beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that's worked for me is I do martial arts, and I cycle and I run, and part of me is I associate with being an athlete, even though I'm not a I'm not an Olympic athlete.
Yeah,
I'm not, you know, I'm very much firmly an amateur, but the fact that I kind of identify, part of my identity is that, then it certainly helps with me in terms of what I, you know, consume, what I take into my body, how, you know, my habits, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And it makes it easier.
Identity is key.
And, yeah.
You know, there are different ways to change your identity in a way, and it can be, and you know, some people are not big on affirmations mm-hmm. or incantations, as Tony Robbins likes to call them. But these can work, because ultimately all that an incantation or an affirmation is doing is you consciously saying something to yourself about yourself. But what happens anyway is that we are unconsciously saying stuff to ourselves about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you're so weak, I've taken the chocolate again.
Right.
Oh, you know, no one, I'm going to go to this party, no one likes me. So we're already doing the
talking. Right, right.
So those people that moan about affirmations are you kind of artificially putting things in.
Yeah,
everything has been artificially put in.
Okay, yes, yeah.
Like the your current identity, whether that's from your parents or your peers growing up or the caregiver or whoever it was,
right,
well-meaning or not, have created an identity. But
and we don't even know we're doing it.
Yeah, and yeah. all of it is made up. Mm. Like, because we've created this in our heads, because we said, okay, well, they said I'd never be a jockey, so
mm-hmm.
you know, somewhere along the lines, I'm never going to be a jockey or whatever. So, and I have self-talk. It's not like I'm sitting here going, oh, I'm perfect or anything like that. It's just that we have self-talk. So the fact that we can recognize this, and this is where NLP can help with that self-talk, is you can shift that, and you can create a voice which is more empowering and can shift your identity. And one of the things I've done, and I've been doing it every morning since I went to Joseph's thing, and it was creating an identity statement of who you uh-huh. want to be. So you say, you know, I, Harry Kalymnos, am a XYZ who does XYZ and blah blah blah. And I've been saying that basically every morning in front of the mirror for 5.5 years. It's just automated now. As soon as I wash my hands, I'm uh-huh. going, oh, Harry Kalymnos, and blah, blah, blah. And pretty soon, after a while, you start to believe it.
Yeah.
So even if it's quote unquote a fib or a lie, because it's all fibs and lies, really.
Mm.
Like the stuff that goes into our heads, where they go, oh, you know, I'm no good at maths. Of course you're no good at maths, because you keep telling yourself that you're no good at maths, and therefore you're not going to try as much, you know. Most skills can be learned too.
Yeah, and I think there's something around the subconscious, and you make little micro adjustments that you don't even know you're making closer towards the thing that you want to be.
Yeah.
Which it's fascinating, because it's all it's all mental, isn't it? At the end of the day,
you have to become the person you want to be before you're that person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're right, it is all mental. We've got Wimbledon on right now, and I remember reading, I think it was Rafa Nadal's book a couple of years ago, and he was saying that on the practice court, you can't really tell the difference between the top 50 players in the world on the practice court. You know, anyone could win. There's nothing in it. When you go to tournaments, though, then it's all mental. It's not the physical ability of that individual, by and large, within the top 50 or so, he was saying.
Yeah.
But it is mental. And we see this all the time in sports. But it's the same in business, or if you're giving a presentation or anything like that. Because ultimately, it's the mind that's going to get you to do things. And it's not to say there isn't an element of the body as well, because, for example, I say, My tagline is train the mind and the rest will follow, because I believe it starts with the mind. However,
hence the thought gym.
Yeah, exactly. The thought gym. It's all about training the mind. But that being said, and I say there's this what I call the thought cycle, and it's that your thoughts will lead to an emotion or a feeling, which will ultimately lead to some kind of action that you take, will then lead to a result. So, for example, if I think I'm a rubbish runner, I've signed up for the marathon. Then I'm going to feel a bit kind of apprehensive about starting my training. I'm going to feel a bit scared. The action I'm going to take is to put it off, not train that much, and then the result on the day will be I'll probably get cramp, I might not finish, which will then circle round to the thought to reinforce the fact I'm not a good runner. If, however, on the other hand, I've never run a marathon before and I'm not really sporty, but I have a feeling or I think that I can accomplish anything because, you know, I set up that business, I, you know, help someone through their divorce, what, blah, blah, blah. Then the feeling I'm going to get is one of expectation, excitement. It's like another challenge that I can look at doing. The action I'm going to take is to buy the runner's magazine, join a running club, put a plan together. The result I'll get is that I'll complete it, and it will just reinforce the idea. So there's four elements in that thought cycle, and you could probably change the idea anywhere in that cycle, whether that's thought or the action or the result. You might get a fluke result one day and then you go, oh, actually, maybe I am pretty good. But the other, say, the other areas in the action point. So I give the example often in my talks that, say, you go to a party and you're not feeling, you know, you're thinking it's rubbish and not really having a good time, but your friend just insists that you come up and dance. And suddenly you're dancing for 5 minutes, i.e. you're taking that action. You're like, you know, you start having a good time, you start thinking and feeling differently. So the mind, the body, you know, you can start with the body, but it might take a bit more external support. It might take something else, like, you know, you might go to a boot camp for a month and then you suddenly got this amazing body and you're like, wow, and that changes your belief and identity about who you are. Or you can try it the other way around as well.
Yeah, interesting. I sometimes maybe the body was that phrase that you know, if you, to change the way that you're feeling, change what you're doing, and so sometimes just being physically active, it has, I mean, it's a reciprocal relationship between mind and body, right? So it's
absolutely
not
you can do it one way or the other. It's like, as I say, you know, I don't sing because I'm happy, I'm happy because I sing. And it's inducing one from the other.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. It's amazing what, you know, what we can actually accomplish, right? And the stuff that people who have done amazing things have managed to do, whether it's compete in ultra endurance events or just doing something organizationally, it's really interesting. I did want to bring it back to this concept of leadership. Partially, the whole Brexit thing is still on my mind. The dearth of leadership, actually, and, you know, regardless of where you are, and probably where you are in the world, it feels like those who, you know, who are ostensibly leaders, it's sometimes hard to see where, you know, those who are nominated formally as leaders, political leaders, particularly. Sometimes it's hard to see where that leadership actually is, and your whole thing is about, you know, you need to master your own, you know, become a leader of your own, you know, yourself, and then you can lead you can lead others. But I'd be very curious around your take on leadership and how you coach it, how you work with organizations to improve it.
Yeah.
You know, how do you spot when it's not where it should be?
Yeah, I mean, where I come in from leadership, it's very different from traditional leadership programs, I guess, because I'm mm-hmm. focusing more on that self, on that person. Mm-hmm. So how do you create a more energized, vital, balanced, resilient individual?
Yeah.
Because then you can add the leadership techniques and tools of how you manage people or influence people.
Okay.
Because the best way really to influence people, I believe, is to be an example that other people want to follow. Because that's also the difference between, I guess, a leader and a manager, or there's many differences, but those people following a leader don't really have to follow the leader. You know, you look at someone like Gandhi or Nelson Mandela, there were examples that people wanted to, not necessarily emulate, but wanted to follow and wanted to serve in some way. And you know, not to say that they were perfect, like anyone's, no one's perfect, but I think when you can demonstrate the qualities within yourself that maybe other people would like to emulate as well, then it's easier to bring them in. If you're someone who is, as a leader, good at maybe making decisions because you have slept enough, you have eaten correctly, you have that cognition in your prefrontal cortex, which declines when you don't sleep enough, and in fact declines with age unless you meditate, in which case it's been shown not to, then you have that cognitive ability, you can make those decisions. You're more balanced, you don't fly off the handle in a meeting when, you know, someone gives you something that you don't want or whatever it might be, and therefore people are then afraid to ever make a mistake or to challenge you because they know you've got to fly off the handle. So if you're just that kind of person, yes, it's absolutely important that you go on all these other leadership trainings and you get all of these balances. But the way I equate it sometimes is like having this amazing Macintosh 1984 computer, and you've got the operating system from back then, and then you've thrown on like the latest version of Pages and Numbers Numbers is the Excel version, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
And Keynote rather than PowerPoint. Yeah. But you throw that onto that rather than upgrading the operating system and the hardware, which is where I'm coming in. And so, yes, the other leadership programs can talk about the traditional elements of leadership, but I guess in a way it's a health and wellness philosophy disguised as a leadership model, because like I say, if it's broken in the first place, there's no point adding things. So I guess for the leaders that we've seen in the Brexit,
you don't have to pick on anyone. It's like Game of Thrones or something at the moment.
I tend to have various news blackouts as well.
Which
is another common thing that I've seen in leaders. In leaders I like to emulate, you know, so there's no news in my house or newspapers. And I've even now recently discovered a Facebook newsfeed blocker. So sorry,
excellent.
Mark Zuckerberg, which means when I log into Facebook, I have a blank newsfeed, which is so amazing, unless I choose to look at something. But I know that various people have left, in fact, pretty much everyone who was doing anything has left their position. So is that a leadership quality you want to emulate, or do you think that maybe not very, they're not very operating from integrity, which I think is a quality that a lot of people like to have and like to say that they've got, and maybe they haven't. You know, they've led the party to wherever they are.
Yeah.
And now they've left. So
I mean, it's look. I see. This is not just about the political situation here or any country. I also see it in organizations where, you know, the thing isn't about leading the organization or leading others. It's about the status of the, you know, the position or the role, getting there, as opposed to, you know, what are you going to do when you get there? You know, it's about, you know, it's actually about ego. You know,
very word
all,
I was gonna say.
All of those things, as opposed to, you know, doing something with it. And I think more and more people can see through that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, and it just the 21st century model of leadership is I don't know if you could say it's broken, but it's certainly different. And I think a lot of individuals who seek that status, I don't think are in many cases largely viewed as really as leaders.
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of people are just in positions of importance or responsibility, but they're not leaders. They're being followed because, you know, they're being,
they have a role, and they have, yeah,
you know, people are following them. But like I say, it's a lot of people are coming from a place of ego and not from a place of service.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to be a leader, you know, ultimately after you lead yourself, you're serving other people. Mm-hmm. If you can serve other people in a positive way that helps impact their lives positively,
yep,
they're going to want to follow, they're going to want to do for the common good, I guess.
Yes.
And so I think what we've seen in certain political areas, it hasn't been necessarily for that common good. It might be, but
it might be.
Like,
I mean,
parachuting out. And you know, certain things have backfired.
Yeah.
But I think both Boris and David Cameron took gambles. David Cameron took a gamble when he announced that there should be a woman as part of his thing.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson anticipated, just wanted to kind of create a little bit of
Noise for himself.
To kind of cement himself as someone.
Yeah.
And didn't really expect it to go that way. And now they've both jumped ship because they don't want to deal with it.
It's a huge for me. It's a huge lesson in the dangers of the ego in both of those cases. But there are circumstances in businesses, all kinds of organizations where, you know, if you act on the basis of your ego, it'll largely backfire.
Yeah,
and absolutely. You know, this is a show about actually risk and resilience, and the risks of doing that as well are pretty high.
Yeah.
Not just to yourself, but to whoever you're leading.
Absolutely. I think you know, we all have ego. I mean, let's not like sugarcoat it. I mean, I've got an element of ego about me.
We all do. Yeah.
How many likes has this post got?
Yeah.
Share? You know, and part of me, the kind of altruistic part, says the reason is that, you know, the more likes and shares, the more people I can reach and help. And that is that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another part of me that wants that kind of from an ego.
We're programmed, you know, that way.
So there's no perfection there from my side, but generally it can backfire.
For me, it's a lot about self-awareness. You know, it's are you aware of how, you know, of what's going on, why you're doing something, your motivations, all that stuff, which comes back to your point about, you know, it's starting with yourself as opposed to, you know, as opposed to some external driver, right?
Absolutely.
And when you lack that self awareness, it's really dangerous.
Yeah.
Really dangerous.
How many I don't know, CEOs, whatever it might be, you know, they want to take over a company or they buy out because of one ego driven reason after another, and actually it's going to cost people their jobs. It's going to cost maybe the business. I mean, where was the biggest? Well, I don't know. I mean, if you remember Enron?
Yes.
I think what was the book that I? Was it the book I read, or it was the show? I can't remember. It was a book. It was looking at, well, I think actually mindset might have played a part in it. Actually, Mindset by Carol Dweck.
Okay, I haven't come across that.
Really interesting book. It talks about having a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So fixed mindset being one that, you know, believes they can't necessarily change,
mm-hmm.
that their success is tied to their mm-hmm. kind of how they're perceived internationally.
Yeah,
And they did it very interesting studies with children at like 5 years old, giving them a test, and those that were performed, that performed well, they said to one group, you know, you did very well in that test, you must be very clever. To the other group, they said, you did very well at that test, you must have worked really hard.
Right.
What was interesting is in the second test, that those people in the first group who were told they were clever had their identity tied to being clever, and therefore were less willing to take risks and make mistakes on the
Right, because they didn't want to be showed up as not so clever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas those that had been told that, you know, their success was driven by their hard work, were prepared to go for it. And then when they went back to the easier level test, the first group did worse than they did originally.
Huh.
But she did a profile of Enron and saying that there was a large culture of fixed mindset people going into that rather and driven by the ego, and they didn't want to be shown to make mistakes, and so they were doing all sorts of crazy stuff. Interesting book anyway, and concept, but yeah, I mean that destroyed a whole company, I guess, you know.
It's fascinating
about Blockbuster as well. I was going to just say subplot. May have come from an ego point of view, was they were saying, well, no, DVD, they're refusing to believe in the tide of the technology.
Yes.
So refusing to kind of think about that. Whereas, you know, this show's all about risk. You look at those that are succeeding, like Reed Hastings, you know, the whole Netflix guy. He took massive risk in getting to where he is now. And you have to take an element, you have to take that risk, but sometimes taking no risk, maybe, or taking what's perceived as the safer path, which Blockbuster would do, didn't do them any favors in the end, you know?
That's right. I think that the point about fear of failure is a really good one. Because you actually, you need to withhold judgment, and the more that you're tied into that external identity, whether it's yourself or a company or an organization, it really paralyzes you. You don't take those risks, and you don't even if you fail, failure is not a bad thing. You learn from it.
It's an opportunity. I like to say, and it's not mine originally, I can't remember where I heard it, but fail means first attempt in learning.
Ah, right, okay.
Because I think as children, we're happy to fail before we get to the school age, you know, because we fail every time we take a step and we fall down, and we're encouraged to keep going. But then when we go to school and we start getting all these test results and we get those 10 marks back and we get 7 ticks and 3 crosses, we're like, okay, focus on that failure point. Why have you failed?
Yeah.
And we become afraid to fail.
Yes.
And anyone who's succeeded in anything in life and business will fail way more often than they succeed. But you only really need to succeed once to kind of be remembered as doing a great thing. But, I can't remember who said it, but, you will fail your way to success.
Yes.
I think, myself included, I have a fear of failing in different areas, whether that might be, a lot of men maybe are afraid to go up to women, because that fear of failing in front of their friends, in front of the girl, whatever, that rejection. But we should, be taught to embrace that idea of failing, because we know that, failing, quote unquote failing, will get you to closer to the successful.
Yeah, I mean, and my sort of philosophy on risk is you want to put yourself in positions where if you fail, it isn't going to be the end of anything. So in other words, obviously don't mortgage your house on
Richard Branson license.
And leverage the upside. So take risks in a way that a failure isn't going to be irreversible. But take a lot of risks. Take a lot of risks that way and fail a lot so that you can get that feedback.
And I think there's a difference between taking a risk and taking a gamble. And I remember
that's good.
Well, Richard Branson once did this TV show, and I didn't really watch it, but it's called The Rebel Billionaire. It was an American thing.
Yeah.
And so the guy got to the final, so he was going to win it. And I think the offer was something like, okay, you can have $500,000, which you can then use for your business and everything else. Or we flip a coin, and it's heads, you get, $1 million. And if it's tails, you get nothing. I think this was a story, so don't quote me. It might be a bit wrong. But the guy was like, no, I'm not going to flip.
Yeah.
And it was something about winning a bit of mentorship as well from Richard Branson. And because he didn't flip, Richard Branson was like, that's good. That's the right thing. Because, you're not, and the reason was, I've got employees, I don't want to risk their thing just because of this ego, I guess, or whatever, of the gamble, because it's a gamble. You don't have any control, really, over that flip. It's a pure casino flip. Whereas a risk is where you look at all the possible things, you mitigate against them, and you proceed anyway, knowing that something could happen.
It could go wrong, but
and that's the difference. And that really always stuck with me, because it's not about taking gambles. Being an entrepreneur is a risky thing. Doing things that is risky, like rock climbing, might be risky. Jumping out of an airplane is risky. But there is a parachute, a second parachute, whatever else. It's just something that stuck with me, the difference between risk and gamble.
That's a great analogy, because the risk taking isn't about recklessness. I say it on my show quite a lot. It is about being intelligent about it. Perfect analogy. Yeah, the gambling analogy is the downside reversible or not? could you recover or not?
Yeah, that's what's the worst that could happen? You can ask yourself this when you're going for something. It's like, you know, what is the worst thing that could happen? And then say, okay, and what would that lead to? And what would that lead to? And then ultimately you might just go, actually, it wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah, that's a great technique as well. Yeah. Like thinking through, envisaging like the worst case scenario. And, can you survive that? What would happen? Oh yeah, I guess it wouldn't be that bad.
To write that down as well. Yeah. Because a lot of time when it's in our head, we can create all manner of things.
Well, because then it's the fear that starts that does the talking, right? So it's it could be 10 times worse than we think it actually would be if you think through it. And
you start a business, it fails. What's the worst again? I'm like, well, okay, I might have to go back to a job. Whatever it might be, but wherever it is for that individual. But sometimes writing it down, you go, actually, it's probably not that bad. At least I'll know that it wasn't the right thing, and I can go through working for someone.
Definitely. I wanted to. I could keep going on
I have this problem, which is probably why I like doing my speaking slots, because I can talk for a long time. So.
Yeah, but it's great. What I did want to do before we kind of put a bow on it and wrap it up is just maybe for people that are listening and they do want to make a few changes, not quite sure where to start or how to go about doing it. And obviously we'll put all the links in the show notes to yourself and your site. Sure. But just how would someone start making a change that they maybe they had on their mind? What are some of the things that
first thing work? We're assuming that they're aware they need to make that change. I guess the easiest thing on this to describe is to find someone who has made a similar change and understand what they did.
Okay.
Because otherwise it's such a broad thing. But that aside, I always say start small.
Mm.
For Pete's sake, start small, because I'm a big fan of small changes. I had a client come to me, she wanted to cycle 4 times a week to work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, how many times are you cycling at the moment? None. Okay, start with one.
Mm-hmm.
Start with once a week. Now, if you overshoot and you get twice a week, I'm not going to tell you off.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if you have one and you double it, that's just an amazing success. Yeah. If you have four and you get three, you're going to feel like a complete failure.
Yeah.
So whether that is, I want to drink less coffee, I drink 5 cups of coffee a day. This is something that really helps me, is ask the question how. Any issue you've got, ask how. So how can I do things so that I can drink less coffee a day? And that to me immediately goes, well, actually, instead of filling the cups all the way, maybe I fill it 3/4 of the way and I put the last, and I dilute it even more than before. Or instead of a heap teaspoon or tablespoon, whatever you put in, teaspoon, I guess, I level it off. And so you start with that small change, or with the 5 cups of coffee, number 3, you make a herbal tea, and just start small rather than go, I've got a friend who's always trying to quit sugar, and I'm like, it's because he thinks he's an all or nothing person.
Mm.
He says, oh, I'm all or nothing. And I'm like, really? Because you've quit sugar like loads and loads of times.
Mm.
So I don't think you are all or nothing. Mm. So try something that doesn't work. Be aware and adapt and change, but my thing is just start small. You want to get up earlier, maybe start getting up 5 or 10 minutes earlier, not half an hour earlier. I have this challenge with people, because sometimes I interact with people and they're like, oh my god, you do this, you do this juicing, you do the rebound, and like my morning routine now extends to like 3 hours. Like if I get up at 6, then I'm ready to rock and roll by 9. But each thing started as a 5, 10, 15 minute chunk.
Okay.
When I started meditating, for example, so a lot of people want to start meditating, right? And they can't sit there cross-legged for 20 minutes. I'm like, don't. I started sitting on my pillow on my bed before I went to bed, and I just breathed 10 times, counting my breath as it went in. So not 10 seconds, but maybe that was 20 seconds. Like, so in one, and then out, maybe, and then in two, and then a week or two later I went to 20 breaths, a week or two later I went to 30. It took me about 6 months to build up to 15 minutes, and now I do maybe 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening, but it has been about 4 years now. Small steps. If you know what the change is, you buy a chocolate bar, you know, eat three quarters of it, give the other quarter to your colleague, mm-hmm. whatever. So just start small, just ask a question, how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. And that, I guess, generates momentum and keeps it. I guess it's all about sustainability in the end.
Absolutely. Consistency. Yeah. Consistency yeah. trumps everything. Like yeah. Imagine this. I was thinking about this the other day. Imagine, like, okay, you're running against Usain Bolt, which is probably a bad example now because he's pulled his hamstring. But yeah, he is super fast, right? But he'll maybe run out of steam. And it's this kind of hare and the tortoise thing. But if I was, like, walking at 1 mile an hour, whatever it might be, and I just consistently stayed that way, I would beat him eventually.
Yeah.
Because he'd just be burning out and keep having to kind of stop start. So
yeah.
Just consistency is king, you know.
Very, very cool, very sage advice, and you know, judging by what you've done, very effective as well. I'd like to wrap it up though. I think it's we've been going for I don't know how long we've actually been going, a couple of interruptions, yeah. So but we going a little bit longer than
yeah,
planned.
No
but
worries.
Just in terms of where people can find you on, you know, on the internet,
yeah.
on social media,
if they want, they can go to www.thethoughtgym.com, so as in thinking, mm-hmm. thethoughtgym.com, and they can sign up. They can get a free series of videos, the first one of which is going to be about how to change a habit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 7-step methodology
cool.
that I created, how to bring that awareness about the mm-hmm. habit as well. So most people are not even aware of their habits.
Mm-hmm.
So how to bring that awareness in and then progress from that. Other than that, I'm very active on social media. So whether that's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, it's The Thought Gym
mm-hmm.
on everything. YouTube, I do a weekly video mm-hmm. about something to do with mindset, or sometimes it's about other things that will help you feel superhuman. So across all of that, it's The Thought Gym. So either go to thethoughtgym.com or one of those social platforms.
Perfect.
Find me there.
Well, Harry, thank you very much for stopping by. This is great. A lot of fun, and you know, I wish you all the best, and you know, continued success. And you know, maybe at some point we'll have you back.
Yeah, yeah. I've had a great time, and I'd love to come back sometime.
Thanks, Harry.
Well, I hope that you found that to be enjoyable, interesting, and also useful. Check out more from Harry. His website is harrykalymnios.com. His book is called The Thought Gym, so do check that out. All the links to everything are in the show notes, so I like to make sure that the show notes are quite detailed on all of my episodes. That way you don't have to go back and listen to things that you thought were interesting but didn't know where to find the link or the recommendation or wherever. All in the show notes. Do check those out. I'm also currently working on the guest lineup for September and October, and I have to say I'm very excited. It's looking really good, shaping up really nicely. You'll have to stay tuned and subscribe and follow along to get those episodes. But I'm very excited. You'll just have to listen in over the coming weeks to find out a little bit more. But I'm sure you'll thoroughly enjoy those conversations. And as I mentioned in the intro, I'd also like to hear from you. I want to know what you like about the show. I want to know what you don't like about the show. I'd love to hear any suggestions for the types of guests you'd like me to have on, or some specific guests. If you've got some names of people in mind that you'd like me to have conversations with, please let me know. Drop me a note on allthingsrisk@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Don't be shy. Let me know what you think. That's it for now, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with more. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.